This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Cardinals have demonstrated that you can nearly collapse at the end of the regular season and have a home run hauled back into the park by an opposition outfielder late in the deciding game of the League Championship Series and still make it to the World Series. The Tigers have proved that you can nearly collapse at the end of the regular season and then mysteriously start looking like your mid-season pitching-rich invulnerable selves once the postseason begins. The series that begins tonight will eventually reveal which flawed team gets to be this year's champion. I wonder if ESPN's Tim Kirkjian, with whom I'll now discuss the matter, feels as if he already knows. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, and probably less worn out than you are. You certainly have my sympathy for all the traveling you've been going through.
But it's worth it, Bill. I got to see one of the great Game 7s I've ever seen at Shea Stadium. And now I get to go cover the World Series, and this is a fact, Bill. If you ask most people, when the playoffs began, there were 8 playoff teams. The 7th and 8th ranked playoff teams with most people would be the Detroit Tigers and the St. Louis Cardinals. And yet, they're playing in the World Series starting tomorrow. The Tigers lost 31 of their last 50 regular season games. No team in the history of baseball has gone 19-31 in their final 50 and advanced to the playoffs. The Tigers did that. The Cardinals were almost as hideous the last 2 weeks, and yet they advanced also. And now these two teams that almost didn't make it to the playoffs are now in the World Series.
It's been a week since the Tigers swept the Oakland A's to advance to the World Series. Detroit manager Jim Leland has presumably spent that time keeping his team sharp and perhaps trying to quit smoking. I don't know, but does the long layoff harm or help that team?
Well, I think it helps in every case. If you look at the 95 Braves, they had a week off before the World Series, and they won the World Series. The 96 Yankees had a week off before the World Series, and they won the World Series. This is a perfect chance to heal all that ails you, to get all your arms ready, and to get everything lined up. Meanwhile, you got the Cardinals, who just played until 12:30 in the morning in order just to get here.
In the rain.
And when they get to Detroit, A, they're going to be exhausted, and B, their two best starting pitchers, Chris Carpenter and Jeff Suppan, will not be available until games 3 and 4. Our big question yesterday was, who in the world are they going to start in game 1? Meanwhile, the Tigers have 4 starting pitchers, all 4 of whom are rested and capable of starting game 1, and I don't think the Cardinals have anyone rested and capable for game 1.
Well, speaking of the Cardinals, Jim Leland's counterpart, Tony La Russa, has taken several great teams to the World Series, both when he was managing St. Louis and managing Oakland, but this could be the worst team he's had there in years. How did he manage to make it back with his squad?
Well, again, that's the question a lot of people are asking right now. Here's what happened. After they almost collapsed, they said to themselves, look, just get us to October, give us a fresh start, and when we get there, we'll be a dangerous club. Nobody quite believed them, but what they've done is they outpitched the Mets out of the bullpen, which was a total surprise in that series. Jeff Suppan suddenly became Bob Gibson. I mean, overnight. I mean, he's not that good, but in the NLCS, he was that good, and they got just enough timely hits, including from a catcher, Yadier Molina, who hit .216 this season and now has batted over .300 in the postseason. That's a first in history, by the way. No one's ever hit under .220 for a season, 400 at bats, and then hit over .300 in the postseason. Never happened before.
Is there any danger that the Tigers, who almost didn't make it to the end of the regular season, show up for Game 1 rather than the Tigers who seem to be so tanned, rested, and ready at this point?
Yes, there's a possibility of that because of the great unpredictable nature of baseball and especially of this postseason. But having said that, the Tigers are on a roll like I haven't seen in a long time. And sometimes you just watch what's really happening there. Watch the way they beat the Yankees, the way they swept the A's, and you have to acknowledge something really special is going on here. And that's what I think is going on in Detroit. One of those crazy years where you just say, this cannot be happening. And then after a while, you just acknowledge, not only is this happening, but it's going all the way. And that's what I think is going to happen with the Detroit Tigers.
Well, just to take the other side, perhaps for the sake of having a counterpoint, what about the possibility that La Russa bringing an underdog team in rather than a heavy favorite wins this one?
Well, I think the chances are not good of that happening. However, I just watched them beat a Mets team that they were not supposed to beat. And this would be typical of Tony La Russa to go to them and tell them today, we have no chance in this. Nobody is picking us to win. We're the underdog by a mile. And instead of saying, oh, we're in big trouble, they say, all right, we'll show them. And they go out and win the World Series. Can that happen? Of course it can. Do I think it is? I'm going to pick the Tigers. But, Bill, I laugh all the time about my picks have gone wrong.
Oh, we do too, Tim.
One of them right in this postseason.
You're a big fan of both Tony La Russa and Jim Leland, or at least it has always seemed that way to me. Do you have a kind of a sentimental pick among those two?
Well, I think you have to really side with Jim Leland just because he was out of baseball for so long. And then when he finally decided that he wanted to get back in it, people told him, no, you're too old. You gave up on the Colorado Rockies a few years ago. You quit. You don't have the fire anymore. So when he finally got a chance to manage again, he told everybody, don't you tell me that I don't have the fire. Don't you tell me that at age 61 I'm too old. He is so fired up and has been from day one about this season. If you don't understand the great story of Jim Leland and this season, and when you talk to the Tigers and you go to Comerica Park, there's signs all over the place, and they're not about Carlos Guillen or Jeremy Bonderman. The signs are about Jim Leland, the manager, and that just doesn't happen in today's age.
All right, Tim. It's clear that you think the Tigers are going to win the World Series. You want to really go out on a limb and tell me how many games it's going to take them?
Yeah, this is going to take 7 games. This is the only way this bizarre postseason and this bizarre season can end. The thought that the Tigers are just going to rifle through the Cardinals, that's not going to happen. The Cardinals are going to give them a hard time, and in Game 7 in Detroit, the Tigers are going to win.
Tim Kirchin covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine, and of course, he's our regular baseball analyst. Tim, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Tim's desperate stab at a Fall Classic winner notwithstanding, there are only 3 guarantees: that one team will win the World Series, one will lose, and the loser will watch morosely from the dugout as the other team celebrates. Why do players engage in this sad ceremony? And why do we as fans love to see it? Reporter Keith O'Brien has this story.
Hard shot, third baseman, grabbed by Brocious, up with it over to first base, and this season is over. And the New York Yankees win the 1998 World Championship rings and the whole works to go with it. Final score, New York 3, San Diego nothing.
Jerry Coleman, the San Diego Padres play-by-play man and former Yankee, doesn't recall hanging around very long after the Yankees swept the Padres in the 98 World Series. But the players felt differently. Before the offseason could begin, it was understood they absolutely had to watch the Yankees celebrate in San Diego's Qualcomm Stadium. Future Hall of Famer and 2-time World Series loser Tony Gwynn was there. He describes the dugout this way.
Quiet. You couldn't hear anything. Nobody said a word. Nobody said a word. I think, coaches sat there for a second, and then they kind of filtered upstairs, but the players sat there and watched. And I remember Derek Jeter being right in the middle of that pile, jumping higher than anybody else, and I remember thinking, God, that must be an awesome feeling to be world champion.
After losing, baseball players linger longer than most athletes do. In the dugout, players feel invisible. There, safe and surrounded by teammates, Gwynn says it's time to think about everything. The pitches you hit, the pitches you missed, the plays you made, and the plays you botched. And so when the Padres lost to the Yankees, that's exactly what he did.
I sat there for about 10 minutes, and at first you're thinking, God, this sucks, them jumping around on our field. Then you're thinking, God, I wonder if we'll have a chance to get back here again anytime soon. Then you're thinking, yeah, season's over. it's just a whole bunch of things go through your mind. And, guys are sitting there. Just stunned.
Pitcher Jim Boughton played for the New York Yankees through the 1960s. He says there was no reason to hang around after World Series losses in 63 and 64 because there was nothing to watch. Players simply didn't celebrate then like they do now.
That sort of came into vogue, I think, in the 1970s or 80s when somebody put a celebration on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and now players played the role of celebrating. And it was like, who can outdo who? Take off your shirt, run around, get on a horse, stand on your head, anything. Maybe you'll be the one who gets your picture in the newspaper celebrating. So it was like they became professional celebrators. And then you know, as punishment, the opposing team would then feel like they were sitting there forced to watch the whole thing, you know, like eat your vegetables.
It baffles Boughton why players would torture themselves like that, and he's not alone.
It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
Sports psychologist Hap Davis understands why fans want to see losing players sitting in the dugout. Research shows that people, especially young people, will fixate longer on negative stimuli, say, for example, video footage of sad players in a quiet dugout. But actually sitting there, Davis says, isn't helping the players.
Research would suggest that what they're really doing then is cementing the negative. They're allowing themselves to feel terrible about something that happened, and it's just not a very constructive state to get into.
Bill the Spaceman Lee agrees.
I take no satisfaction in watching other people jump around.
The former Red Sox pitcher remembers losing to the Cincinnati Reds in Game 7 of the 1975 World Series, but he doesn't recall lingering to watch any celebration, and he doesn't understand why anyone would.
The game's over, they're living in the past, they're not moving on with their lives, and they like to go home and hit themselves on their thumbs with hammers during the off season. Pack your bags, leave, get on with your life. You know, it's just a ball game.
Tony Gwynn, however, still believes in the power of watching. Now the head baseball coach at San Diego State University, he says if his players ever make it to a championship game and lose, he will tell them to watch the other team celebrate. You do it to remember, he says, and you do it to reflect. You do it because you're angry and because you're sad and because from the dugout you can. And this year's World Series losers will be no different.
Those guys are going to be sitting there on that bench and they're going to be watching. They're going to be. And they ain't going to be watching because the cameras are there. They're not going to be watching because they think that's the thing to do. You know, you just can't help but when you get beat and a team wins and celebrates right in front of you, you're going to watch. You're going to.
For Only a Game, I'm Keith O'Brien.
Your winning side up, up. Help the team to come through. Do any your name they'll choose for the sporting news. Keep your sunny side up. Win the All-Star game. Make the Hall of Fame. Keep your sunny side. Give the ball the ride. Keep your sunny side up.
It's... I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce on the World Series, Major League Soccer's playoffs, and various other spectacles. But first, in Blindside, subtitled Evolution of a Game, Michael Lewis tells two stories that seem bound to intersect in the football career of a young man named Michael Orr. The first story concerns Orr himself, an enormous and enormously disadvantaged black teenager living by his wits in a Memphis housing project who's absorbed into a very wealthy white family. The second story is the tale of how the position of left tackle, the position Michael Orr was apparently born to play, has become one of the most lucrative jobs in pro sports. Joining me now in the studio is Michael Lewis, the author of The Blind Side. Michael, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thanks, Bill.
Fascinating as the story of Michael Orr is, you chose to open The Blind Side with a story of what former New York Giants linebacker Lawrence Taylor did to former Washington quarterback Joe Theismann 21 years ago. Why was that?
Because this, in a way, sets up why Michael Orr was so valuable. He wasn't there to prevent Lawrence Taylor from getting to Joe Theismann. Lawrence Taylor ends Joe Theismann's career on Monday Night Football in one of the most gruesome scenes ever seen on television in a football game. And Lawrence Taylor was in the process of redefining the blind side pass rush. The blind side of a right-handed quarterback was where behind his back was where Lawrence Taylor came from. And as Lawrence Taylor told me, I liked to come from there because it scared him. They didn't know I was there, so the hit was always unexpected. And you could cause all kinds of damage. Usually you knock the ball loose from the quarterback's hands. Sometimes you knock the quarterback from the game. In this case, you ended the quarterback's career. And because of both the increasing importance of the passing game through the 80s and 90s and the increasing lethality of what is directed at the quarterback from his blind side to disrupt that game, a premium comes to be placed on the left tackle on the offensive line whose job it is to stop the Lawrence Taylor type from getting to the quarterback. So, oddly, what has happened, the left tackle on the offensive line, he has gone from being the lowest paid player on the field, along with his fellow offensive lineman, to the second highest paid player on the field. behind only the quarterback. The combination of physical attributes that is necessary to play this position well, it is a combination that is very seldom found in a single human being. It's 6'5 or taller, it's 320 pounds or heavier, all together with an incredible agility and quickness. And because it's so rare to find that package, when it's found, it's like a gold strike. It's a eureka moment, and people know it. They say, oh my God, look at that. This guy is born to play left tackle.
Michael Orr might never have come to the attention of any football coach anywhere had it not been for a man who called himself Big Tony and who was going to enroll his own son in a private Christian school and thought, he might as well take Michael along for the ride. Tell us about Michael Orr's circumstances at that time.
Michael Orr had just turned 16 years old. He was one of 13 children that a crack-addicted woman had in the inner city Memphis by six or seven different men. Michael himself had been to 11 different schools, but he had missed as much as he'd made school, and mm-hmm. he couldn't read or write. His IQ had been tested at 80. He was homeless in that he didn't have one home, but he sometimes slept on the streets, but a lot of times talked his way into other people's houses. In fact, as he did with Big Tony, he was sleeping on Big Tony's floor for a couple of months because he'd become friends with Big Tony's son. He lived in the part of Memphis that was actually the third poorest zip code in the United States. And even there was an underclass in the underclass, and that's the class to which he belonged. He was as destitute as a person can be.
Michael was spectacularly unequipped for admission to private school. How did he get in?
Big Tony took his son over to the Briarcrest Christian School, which is on the other side of Memphis from where Michael grew up, and it's rich, white, evangelical Christian Memphis. And when the academic people at Briarcrest looked at Michael's transcripts, they said, this is pointless. However, while he was wandering around the school being introduced by Big Tony to people, one of the people he meets is the football coach. The football coach took one look at him and, oh my God, he was 6 foot, 5.5 inches, 350 pounds mm-hmm. at the age of 16. And the football coach said, give him a shot. Now, the principal of the Christian school didn't care very much about football, and he said, no. And he sent Michael Orr off. And Michael, he said there was something about Michael that made you want to help him because he was very gentle and sweet-natured and quiet and completely lost. I mean, as the principal said, when I just talked to him, I realized that he didn't know what an ocean was. He didn't know how to shake hands, that it was as if he'd been locked in a closet for the first 15 years of his life. And he didn't want to send him away without hope. So he told Michael that if he enrolled and was able to pass correspondence courses at a school called the Gateway Christian School, they would reconsider his case. Well, Michael goes off, takes himself formally out of school, and enrolls in a correspondence school, and can't function, of course. He can't read the materials, and he's not even enrolled in public school anymore. At that point, the principal of the Briarcrest Christian School said he felt guilty, and the least we could do is give him one shot. And he figured that he'd come in for a year and would wash out probably because he was so ill-equipped. And he came for a year and, for a variety of reasons, didn't wash out. And the biggest reason of all was that he was taken in by one of the families who had children at the school, the Toohey family, a very well-to-do white evangelical Christian family, and they took him on as a project.
At what point did the football coaches at Briarcrest Academy know that they had a phenom on their hand?
The coaches all kept an eye on him. It wasn't just the football coach. The basketball coach said that when he walked across a basketball court, he thought, that kid is so wide, if I just stuck him under the basket, he will be, you know, nobody's going to be able to get a rebound. He'll own the paint kind of thing. And so he just wanted to see if he was coordinated enough to maybe do that for him once he became eligible to play sports. And the basketball, he threw him a basketball just to see how he'd react. And Michael took the ball, dribbled between his legs three times, spun around, out to the three-point line, hit a three-point shot. And the basketball coach said, oh, my God. This is a body bigger than most NFL linemen, and it's moving like a point guard. So they knew he had an unusual combination of talents.
It's impossible to imagine that he would ever have succeeded at Briarcrest Academy, on the field or off, were it not for Sean and Leanne Toohey. Tell us a little bit about them.
Sean Toohey was a poor boy in a rich white private school in New Orleans growing up. And he got by on his wiles and his athletic ability. He was a great point guard, was a star point guard at Ole Miss, at University of Mississippi, was drafted by the New Jersey Nets, though he never played in the NBA. His wife he met, she was a cheerleader at Ole Miss. She converted him from a kind of lapsed New Orleans Catholic to an evangelical Christian. And they, partly, I think, well, not just partly, largely because of the combination of their faith and Sean's background, have taken a special interest in the poor kids who happen to come through their kids' school. Mm-hmm. And for years they have kind of identified them and just helped out here and there. So he meets Michael Orr very early in Michael Orr's career at the Briarcrest Christian School because he's so conspicuous. And they have a discussion about what Michael's eating for lunch, and Sean quickly realizes he's not eating lunch and that he's sitting around hungry all day. And so he covers his lunch tab. A few weeks later, Michael Orr is on with the rest of the school on Thanksgiving break, and Sean and Leanne Toohey are driving down the streets of Memphis, and it's snowing. And ahead of them, coming off the city bus, comes this enormous kid. And Sean goes, "Hey, that's that kid I was telling you about. That's Big Mike." And Leanne looks at him and says, "He's wearing shorts and a T-shirt in the snow." And Sean says, "Well, that's what he wears every day to school because that's clearly the only clothes he has." And she makes her husband pull over, and she meets Big Mike and starts to grill him. "What are you doing out here kind of in the middle of nowhere in the snow in your shorts?" And he says he was going to the Briarcrest School gym. Even though it's locked up, he thinks he can sneak in. And she said, "Well, you know, why you want to do that?" And he said, "Well, they have heat there." And so it became clear instantly to her that this was a boy who not only had no clothes to wear in the snow, he maybe was out in the snow permanently. She basically threw her husband out of the car, and she put Big Mike in, and she took him to go shopping for clothes. What happens is, you know, she realizes he's got no place to sleep, he's got no one taking care of him, that she requests his transcripts from Briarcrest. She realizes he's sitting in these classrooms and getting Fs, and he's going to wash out of the school. So she starts to steadily take over his life until 6 months later, he's sleeping in their house.
She's also provided a personal tutor who gets him through all his classes.
6 months later, she's got a personal tutor she's layered on, and he would come home from school, and he would spend the next 6 hours being taught. It was very stressful for him, but over a period of a couple of years, he is transformed by the experience. He learns how to read and write. His IQ jumps between 20 and 30 points. He becomes a confident and more sociable person, very comfortable in his surroundings. And I think the confidence translated into his athletics, and he became this football superstar.
Sean and Leanne Toohey understood how good a football player Michael Orr could be, so they wanted him to play in college in order that he might one day play in the pros. Is it fair to say that to get Michael to college, they slipped under and around a lot of rules meant to prevent colleges from enrolling young men strictly to play football?
Oh, my God, they rigged the system, yes. But you know, from the moment he kind of moved in with them, his grades at the Briarcrest School got good. His senior year, he was on the honor roll every year, but he had all Fs his freshman and most of his sophomore year. And so cumulatively, he didn't have an adequate grade point average. Now, the NCAA, in their regulations, has some extraordinary loopholes. And one of the loopholes is that you can replace the grade from a semester of work in high school with a grade you obtain from Brigham Young University in a correspondence course that takes only 10 days to complete.
Mm-hmm.
And thus began what became known in the Toohey household as the Great Mormon Grade Grab.
They even called it that.
With Sean tutoring Michael through these internet courses, at the end of every 10 days, he would get an A, and then it would replace some F that he got his freshman or his sophomore year. And in a matter of months, they had a renovated transcript that was good enough to enable him to go to college.
My guest is Michael Lewis, author of The Blind Side, Evolution of a Game. You're listening to Only a Game. After his freshman season at the University of Mississippi, during which Michael won all sorts of recognition and awards, one of his teammates insulted him. Michael beat the teammate up and also inadvertently injured a little boy. The boy's parents initially indicated that they would bring charges of some sort against Michael Orr. How was it that that incident never interrupted Michael's progress as a football player?
What happened after that was a tribute to the power of having connections. Had Michael just been another black football player, that incident could have, I don't know if it would have ended his career, but it would have caused a lot of trouble for him. Instead, he has not only rich white parents, but rich white parents who are very prominent Ole Miss graduates and involved in the affairs of the university from top to bottom, who can call the chancellor and say, you know, how you doing? Take care of Michael, if you would. And Michael, poor black football player, is essentially treated as the son of a rich white alum. And so this is all part of a larger pattern in Michael's life. Up to the age of 16, everything in the world is rigged to ensure his failure. The moment he crosses over into the privileged world, everything in the world is rigged to ensure his success. And this is just one other incident that could have gone a completely different direction, but because now everything's stacked in his favor, it didn't.
Well, my last question was going to be, what's your best guess about how things will go for Michael Orr once he's no longer under the supervision of the TUIs and no longer being tutored on a daily basis by hired tutors? But it sounds as if you think that probably, all other things being equal, he'll do fine.
I got to know him very early on in the story, before he was actually discovered as a football player. And he is a different human being now than he was 3 years ago. One time he said to me, you know, I feel smarter because I know what things are. He's no longer reminded every day of his own ignorance. In fact, he's figured out he's just as smart as everybody else and probably shrewder and better designed for survival because of the experience he had his first 16 years. I think he's likely to have an interesting career one way or the other.
Michael Lewis is the author of The Blind Side, Evolution of a Game, published by Norton. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're listening to Only a Game. David Lees of Lexington, Massachusetts, emailed this week to ask if I am related to Dick Littlefield, who compiled a 4.71 earned run average and a one-loss record of 33-54 while pitching for 11 different major league teams between 1950 and 1958. I'm not, and though I'm sure he was a good guy, the attempt by the New York Giants to trade him to the Dodgers for Jackie Robinson was just silly, even though Mr. Robinson was ready to retire. Gail Merrick, who hears Only a Game on WCBE in Columbus, Ohio, emailed to say that my offhand reference to Ring Lardner, who once wrote, "Shut up," he explained, had delighted her. This quote was a favorite of our son, who left for college 2 months ago. It was like hearing his voice in our home again. Thank you, from the bottom of a lonely mother's heart. My conversation with Phil Hose and his second cousin Don Larson 2 weeks ago pleased a number of listeners. From Boca Raton, Florida, Chuck Sussman wrote, "I was 8 years old when Don Larson pitched the perfect game. I'll never forget Yogi jumping into Larson's arms. It's so vivid it seems like yesterday. Thank you for presenting the interview." Among the others who wrote to say they enjoyed that interview was Maya Hasegawa, who lives in Roxbury, Massachusetts. "I'm cooking dinner," she wrote, "but had to stop to tell you what a wonderful story this was. I was a Dodger fan growing up in New Jersey, but Don Larson is one classy guy." In response to our story about Duke University students camping out on campus so they would be eligible for a lottery distributing tickets to basketball games, Mark Davidson, who hears the program on WCPN in Cleveland, wrote, "I am a Duke Fuqua School of Business graduate, and I thought your story provided a very accurate depiction of the event. It was one of the highlights of my Duke career, hanging out with friends, eating junk food, drinking cheap beer. As an aside, I slept in the back of my SUV, rolled over on my keys, and set off my car alarm." Gee, that must have delighted your fellow campers. You can tell us how you feel about the stories you hear on Only a Game by writing us at WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. The easiest way to reach us is through the website, onlyagame.org, or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com. This is NPR, National.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. If you're going to play on this team, you're wearing the spandex. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
The hell I am.
It is your custom to say at the end of each football season that the Super Bowl is good. Have you an invocation for the series of baseball games set to begin tonight?
Yes. The World Series is on, and it's time for Tony La Russa to turn into Mickey the Dunce.
So, which fans will be rewarded this autumn? The ones who have waited so patiently for 22 years or those who have kept the faith for 24 years?
I think whoever it is that lives in the in Detroit Rock City are going to be the people who are happiest at the end of this World Series. I think they're a much better team than the Cardinals, and their pitching is intact, as was not the case with the New York Mets. And can I just say for the record that Adam Wainwright's final pitch of the National League Championship Series was the greatest pitch I've ever seen. It is always difficult when Uncle Charles drops by to call.
It is indeed, even when you're a Major League veteran. The annual shuffling of the managers is underway, and Lou Piniella, who endured four frustrating seasons with the Devil Rays, has landed with the Chicago Cubs, so no more frustration for him, right?
You ain't seen nothing yet, big fella. Guess what? There's already 30% of your fan base who thinks you should be fired.
Piniella has declared that, quote, urgency is important. What does that mean?
I don't know. I guess he's decided to be urgent immediately instead of tomorrow or the next day.
The A's, meanwhile, fired Ken Maka. Will urgency be important to whoever gets hired by them, too?
The problem with the A's, and it is actually a problem, is you've got to hire somebody who, when Billy Bean's genius finally runs out of gas in October, like it always does, has to take the fall. I mean, I think that's on the business card of the Oakland A's manager. Has your name, Oakland A's manager, Billy Bean scapegoat.
Would it be an overstatement to suggest that Major League Baseball's most recent licensing agreement is morbid?
No. Why are people so outraged about this?
I'm not outraged.
People
I'm just wondering if it should be called
morbid.
The
sports punditariat are outraged because you can get a Philadelphia Phillies casket, which is in some ways redundant, but not outrageous.
And an urn. You can get an urn if you choose to go in that
right.
direction.
That's right. You can now say how much does a Philadelphia Phillies earn, and the answer is unquestionably not enough.
Major League Soccer's playoffs.
Yay!
Today, life is good. You got a pick for
happy,
round
happy,
one.
Happy, happy, joy. No, but I do have a great name. I'm following this guy. I don't know if he's any good. DC United's guy, Aleko Eskandarian.
He's
because
very
there
good.
Aren't enough Alekos in our lives.
The FBI said on Thursday that the dirty bomb threats against six NFL stadiums were a hoax, and furthermore, that the threats were part of a writing duel. You're a writer. What does that mean?
Well, I'll tell you, and my seconds will be along presently. But the only people I would duel with are publishing house publicists. Guys, if there's anything that I don't want any more of, is telling me there's a threat and telling me to go on with my life. If there's a threat during which I can go on with my life, don't tell me about the freaking threat. If there's a threat where I should change my plans, tell me about that one.
There you go. This week, the Falcons and the Lions each lost a player to steroid policy violation, and the Packers lost one to the substance abuse policy as well. In the latter case, Packers quarterback Brett Favre says the league was irresponsible. You agree with that?
The league is harsh, and I think the league is probably, if you believe that it's within its rights to police its players off the field, then it's probably right on Corin Robinson. I mean, Corin Robinson was already in the league substance abuse program. He shouldn't have been drunk. He certainly shouldn't have been driving drunk. I don't care whether you're in the NFL substance abuse program or not. You shouldn't be doing that. But to make him a non-person, I'm frankly on Favre's side. I think that there's a certain amount of demonstrating to the world that we're tough that chews up human beings.
Yeah, the idea here being you're not only going to be suspended, you're not supposed to come by, you can't talk to anybody on the team.
And what are the odds, by the way, that somebody in the substance abuse program, completely cut off from their livelihood, is going to go back to abusing the substance?
Turning to college football, following the game between Miami and Florida International last week, Miami had 13 players suspended for fighting. Will they have anybody left this week to play Duke?
Yes, because they've tempered justice with mercy at America's finest institution and formerly the largest CIA station on the mainland United States. And the people who were involved, apparently the only person that can really lose their job behind this is Lamar Thomas, the radio guy who was bellowing about taking care of his house.
And
his
wanting house. To go down the elevator and get involved.
And
as
by
well.
The way, we haven't seen any comments, by the way, on the vicious brawl between Holy Cross and Dartmouth, which took place on exactly the same day.
Holy Cross. The first numbers are in for the National Hockey League, and the news is not good for Commissioner Bettman, at least in Chicago, Los Angeles, and Colorado. What's going on here? Delayed anger reaction for the lost 04-05 season?
I think it's a function of how long the season is, how early it starts. This is not good, though, because these are major markets. Certainly Los Angeles and Chicago are self-evident. Colorado is not that far long removed from a Stanley Cup and is a terrific hockey place.
Well, they had a long string of sellouts, which
and,
now is no
and,
more.
And, I mean, they had played for 487 consecutive sellouts, and they couldn't sell out, you know, the beginning of the season. That is not good either.
Whatever else you might say about Philadelphia Flyers owner Ed Snyder, you can't help but admire his candor, unless, of course, you're on the roster of his team, I guess.
Yeah, they lost to Buffalo 9-1, and he ordered that three players be cut immediately. How he decided this, I have no idea, but frankly, he told the press, the whole damn team stinks. Well, you own it, pal. I mean, if it's
whose fault is that?
Some defenseman's out on the street selling apples, and you're making money.
In college basketball, Texas Tech, which gave Bob Knight a three-year extension just 2 years ago, is about to do it again. What, are they afraid they wouldn't be able to find anyone else to coach the Red Raiders through 2012?
God, poor Bob. He just can't get past the parole board down there in Lubbock, can he? Sentenced through 2012. He wants the record. He wants Dean Smith's record for total wins in college basketball. He'll get it down there. He's 10 short. He'll probably get it this year. Extension on college basketball coach contracts are exactly like guaranteed money in football. They're not worth the single digit that's printed on the paper. He's not going to be there through 2012, I don't believe. But he will be there long enough to go past Dean Smith, and I think that's all he's hanging on for right now.
And finally, Charlie, in elementary school,
of
where we're sitting has apparently banned fun. Have I got that right?
Yes, they're not going to allow the children to play tag because of things that happen when you play tag, usually being tagged, but I guess nobody at the Willett Elementary School in Attleboro, Massachusetts is it anymore.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. His new book, Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything, has begun to appear in the mailboxes of influential reviewers, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, I say when Paul starts up the tag game by the river, well, I don't care if it's cold for swimming or if I shiver, and I can see Paul looking around. Time for tag. Oh, I don't care. When Paul starts up the tag game, I'll be there. Oh, do it, do it. It's the tag game. Do it, do it. It's the tag game. Do it, do it. It's the tag game. Do it, do it.
Before this fall's volleyball season began, the girls' team at Holliston High School had been something of a pushover in the otherwise competitive Tri-Valley League, which consists of 10 schools just west of Boston. Over the past three seasons, the team was, well, let's let Holliston High Athletic Director Jim Carboneau do the math.
Girls' volleyball was in a bit of a slump. They were 0-20 my first year, 0-20 my second year, and 4-16 last year. So, we're trying to build it up. We got them the new uniforms. We're trying to generate interest. We started a middle school program for volleyball this fall. So we're doing everything we can to bring it back to where it was.
Though the 06 Holliston girls team boasts 9 wins against 7 losses, it isn't back to where it was. It is somewhere else entirely. That's because of the presence on the team of the only player who can legitimately be called unique, although this player says that circumstance doesn't explain the team's resurgence.
I'm a member of the team, and I play my hardest, and I practice hard, and I always go 100%, but in no way am I responsible for turning the team around. I mean, I do my part, and I get credit for that, but, I mean, the girls are just tremendous.
Dan Dreving, a senior at Holliston High, is the only boy on the girls' volleyball team. In fact, he's the only boy on any team in the Tri-Valley League. He's also one of the very few players who'd never tried organized volleyball before this season. Perhaps even more remarkable is the fact that joining the team wasn't Dan's idea, according to Holliston co-captain Allie Kohler.
Well, we kind of encouraged him to try out for the team a little bit, and I don't know if we thought it would like actually happen, but it has, and it's been fun so far. But I think basically, it was something we knew about last year possibly happening.
Dan Drebbing could happen to the Holliston girls volleyball team because there wasn't and isn't a Holliston boys volleyball team. Tri-Valley Conference rules, like the rules of lots of other conferences, allow such things under such circumstances, which explains why young women have occasionally competed on football teams, otherwise populated entirely by young men. In such circumstances, a major concern is safety. In volleyball terms, what might happen if a relatively large, relatively strong, relatively excellent male volleyball player were to spike a ball onto a relatively small girl on the other side of the net? According to Jim Carboneau, his fellow administrators recognize that Dan Drebbing would be unlikely to present that sort of problem.
We're a very competitive league in volleyball, and one of the athletic directors said that the only person he's going to hurt is himself, because he saw a couple, one of the jamborees, and Dan was obviously his first or second week out, and he was, you know, he took one off the nose, he took one off the head, you know, he fell into the net, I think, you know, just, so he was not a volleyball player, so he's not going to revolutionize the league.
Maybe not, but the Holliston team has won 9 matches this fall. If they can win just one more out of their final 4, they'll make the postseason tournament. Sitting in a classroom with co-captains Allie Kohler and Sarah Cady before Wednesday night's match against Ashland High School, Dan Drebbing mused on the short, strange trip it's been so far.
I think that a lot of people think I'm doing it to get attention, but I don't know why they think that I would do something that would attract this much negative attention to myself for attention. I mean, obviously, I've talked to newspapers and stuff, and I'm talking to you, and it's great fun, but I have other commitments in my life. I play drums. I could be out playing drums in a band. I could be playing club lacrosse. I don't need to be playing volleyball to be making myself into an individual in any way.
I also love the fact that you have a beard. I mean, it's somehow right that a member of the women's volleyball team should have a beard.
Yeah.
It's a very modest sort of blonde beard, but it's a beard, right?
Yeah, it's a beard.
The negative attention to which Dan Drebbing refers hasn't escaped the notice of Jim Carboneau, though he says it hasn't been as bad as he thought it might be.
I haven't seen any blatant, outwardly issues from any parents or coaches, but you do see a couple comments, or you see, you know, the heads get together and they start whispering and pointing, and then, you know, to our team's credit, we have beaten a couple teams that we haven't beaten since probably the turn of the century, of the 19th century, not the 21st century. So, you know, we beat a couple teams that we haven't beaten in many, many, many years. And to the coach's credit, to one coach's credit, he out on the paper said it, we didn't lose the game because the boy was on the other team. We lost the game because they played better than us. I really appreciated that.
When Jim Carboneau and the players headed into the gym to watch the freshman and JV girls contest preceding the varsity game, I followed them. In the bleacher at one end of the room, I met Paula and Scott Kohler, the parents of Allie, the player who'd first suggested to Dan Drebbing that he try out for the team. The Kohlers haven't missed a match this fall, and I asked Allie's mom to tell me about the worst heckling she'd heard.
Oh, don't even go there. It's just not appropriate. Yeah.
That bad?
I think so. And, you know, a lot of times it doesn't always come from the kids. A lot of times it comes from the other parents, which really is very, very sad to me. And you know, the acorn doesn't fall far from the tree, so the kids are picking it up from the parents. But I've had to move, like physically move, because I've just been so surprised at what some of the parents have said. So, and it's sad.
Dan Drebbing denies that what heckling he's heard has disturbed him. And Scott Kohler says that in at least one instance, Allie has been able to turn the nastiness to the Holliston team's advantage.
I know that my daughter in one huddle, she heard kids, sort of catcalling them and whatever, and she said, all right, Dan, don't you listen to that. The rest of you kids, let's get mad. Let's beat them, you know. So it's been sort of a motivating factor for the team, having some of that, behavior that we've seen.
That motivating factor, a substantial contribution of athleticism from the captain of the girls' basketball team, and the addition of a transfer student from Pennsylvania with considerable volleyball experience, have added up to the best girls' volleyball team Holliston High has seen in some time. But on Wednesday night, it wasn't quite good enough to win the match that would have clinched a place in the tournament. On his first touch, Dan Drebbing whacked the ball into the top of the net, and though he put away several shots in the ensuing action, Holliston had to content itself with winning only the first game in a match they lost 3-1 against Ashland High School. The team's next opportunity to ensure that they'll be playing beyond the regular season comes tonight when Holliston faces Millis High. But even if they fail to win any of their final four matches, this season is likely to be remembered, at least in Holliston, for the way it has renewed hope in girls' volleyball, in part thanks to the efforts of Dan Drebbing, even when he's on the bench.
We don't wave towels, but yeah, I do. We do cheer on the sideline. I do cheer. And trying my hardest usually means, going all out in the game, but yeah, it means supporting the team when I'm not playing and in practice and in every context possible. Watching the JVs and the freshmen and supporting them and giving them advice. Yeah, it means.
With your 2 months' worth of experience.
Well, whatever. I give it up with I tell them to take it with a grain of salt.
If all goes according to athletic director Jim Carboneau's plan, there will be no boys in spandex next season. He anticipates Holliston will be bringing back a male team. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Elias, Sports Bureau Feldman. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view my co-ed volleyball photo gallery, learn more about The Blind Side, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Holliston High School Athletic Director Jim Carboneau, who assesses girls volleyball team member Dan Drebbing thusly.
He's a good athlete, and he's getting to be a better volleyball player, but he's not Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Well, then it's a good thing Dan's not on the girls' basketball team, isn't it? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National.